And we are live. Welcome, folks, to today's episode of the Survival Podcast. We are up to episode 3,514 of the Survival Podcast, and we're going to talk about homesteading in the suburbs, or really small property homesteading today. I'm going to borrow a lot from what Nick Ferguson and I talked about last week. I got my mind in this space. An expert council member, Ken Berry, reached out to me. He's going to have me on his farm YouTube channel in August to talk about this as well. I thought this would be a good primer for that. Get me thinking right so that when he interviews me, I have a lot of things to talk about. Last time Ken and I talked about this, he started with doing in an apartment, and there's inherent limitations there, and I'm going to try to steer him right toward a similar conversation that we're going to have today as just one-on-one. And it's because I really think if you really want to grow a significant amount of food, other than doing some like indoor hydro or something like that, you could do some stuff in apartments. But if you really want to be somewhat self-sufficient with your food, if you want to get up into, you know, where you're producing 40-50% or more of your own food, you need a little bit of land. But you don't need much. You know, there's land. Everybody wants land. I need 80 gajillion acres, you know, so that I can grow pigs and cows and whatever, sheep. And, you know, if you want to do that, I don't want to rain on your parade at all. Just a lot of times, it's a lot harder than people think. Big pieces of land, especially the land that we're talking about when we start talking that way, which is not wooded land, right? We're talking about pasture, and there's a certain amount of grazing that has to be done to maintain it. And if you can't sufficiently graze it, then you got to mow it or you got to brush hog it, and it wears you out. You know, my wife and I, we have 3 acres here, and sometimes we go, you know, since we can never forest this whole place because there's not enough dirt here, maybe we should go. I mean, it would be hard to do at this point. We got 10 years invested in it. Maybe we should get some place in the woods with a little 1 acre to half acre open and the rest just woods so that people stay away from us. And even though that wouldn't be the burbs, because I can't live in the burbs again. I can't do it. I cannot have a Karen on my street calling code enforcement on me. I can't do it. This is still the approach you would take. And if you have the great big property, like if you're like, Jack, I'm going to listen today, but honestly, this just isn't for me. I got me my 20 acres and my cattle and my pigs and my – everybody should do what we're going to talk about today. Because what we're really talking about today – is zone 1 and 2 intentional permaculture design and regenerative practices thereof. And so if you're designing a large property that has a zone 1 through 5, you still have a zone 1 and 2. And your zone 1 probably is about the same size. Your zone 2 might be a bit bigger, but in the end, we're talking about the intensively managed components to the system. And we can do so much with so little because there are some inherent advantages we're going to go through today. We'll talk about that. I'm going to teach you how to act as your own consultant today. See, whenever I talk to people, do I put in this or do I put in this or do I put in, like, they start just listing all these tactics and techniques, hooviculture mounds, aquaculture, aquaponics, rabbits, right? Like, until you gain context, you really don't know what you should be designing. Everybody puts tactic and technique ahead of strategy. It is so imperative, and this is designing a business, designing a life, designing a homestead. I don't care what you're designing. The strategy has to come first, or we pick inappropriate techniques and we tactically employ them in the wrong order, the wrong place, the wrong connections. If we start out with a very clear strategy, then we can get very, very clear on our context, so we're able to bring things in with that. So we're going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about some real advantages of small properties and acknowledge some of the inherent limitations, and then we're going to go through a whole bunch of stuff you can do, rabbits and chickens and all the techniques that you actually want to hear about, but we're going to frame a context with it first. I hope that really helps you guys in designing your own properties. Again, whether you have a small property that you don't think is enough, and it probably is, or whether you have a large property, but it kind of gets away from you, get the intensively managed things done first, and your life will just be better. All right, while we're talking about that, I want to bring something up that I was actually going to say for the end, which is the item of the day today. And It's because something just came to my attention. It's the Vivor ice maker, the 37-pound countertop ice maker that I featured yesterday. A ton of y'all bought one. I'm not sure exactly because the reporting lags from Vivor, but well over 20, I'm going to say that. This thing was a smoking deal, and it's no longer on I got the wrong screen up there. Give me just a second. It is no longer on sale from Vivor. The price actually just went up higher than the stated retail of $289. It went up to $300 and some odd. It also says it's on clearance. I guess the sale worked, and a huge swath of inventory went out the door, and Vivor called, like, put on the brakes. However, Vivor also does sell through Amazon, and I don't know how long the price will stay where it is, but right now that same item can be ordered on Amazon for $169 versus almost $350. You see where I'm going with this? I just added a note to the write-up right at the top, big bold red. And I'm sure even though I did that, I'm still going to get emails. Chuck, I clicked on it. It's $348. Yes. Did you read the note at the top that gives you the Amazon link? If you want to get this product at this price, I would do it now. I don't know if Vivor is going to discontinue this item once it's sold out. I don't know what's going on here. I do know why the Amazon price is where it is, because anybody that sells on Amazon at scale is doing FBA, that's fulfilled by Amazon. That means that there's a certain number of these that are not in Vivor's possession. They're in Amazon warehouses, so they're allowing that inventory to come down separately. So this is one of the few instances where you're going to be able to get a Vivor product. You won't be able to get my additional 5 points off, but you'll get it much lower on Amazon than you will on Vivor. It's the same product, so why not? Again, I heard from tons of you guys that picked this up. I think it's an outstanding product. I am very happy with mine. I'm glad I got it when I did. And I just would say that if you want to kind of up your game with, you know, ice production at home, which is a prepper topic, somebody pointed out it's also a medical issue because ice does a lot in medical emergencies, swelling, cooling during overheating, all kinds of stuff like that. Probably something every prepper should have. It takes a lot less energy to run a countertop ice maker than a freezer. And this thing makes ice really fast, and it makes really great ice. I mean, the kind of little pellet ice that you get when you go to a convenience store. So I did want to point that out up front because, again, if you're watching the live stream or you're getting the podcast early, you know, right after it's published, it's not a sales technique, guys. I really just don't know how long that particular item is going to be around. And it sucks for me because it was selling like freaking gangbusters, which is probably why it's gone. Next up, let's take care of our sponsors of the day real quick today. Berkey, Jeff the Berkey Guy Gleason with USABerkeyFilters.com. Jeff's been in the business forever. Water is incredibly important. And being able to make sure you have safe, clean drinking water at all times is important. And if you're going to get a Berkey system, and it's probably the most cost-advantageous system you can get, it can't fail. There's no moving parts. It's easy to maintain. It looks great. Get it from the Berkey guy. Get it from the largest dealer of Berkey products in the United States, someone that can fix your problems if you have one quickly, and someone that's been supporting the show that you know and love for a very long time. Next up, John Pugliano with the Wealth Steading Podcast. John is one of us. He is a prepper. He's a ham radio operator. He's been working with me since 2010. He answers your questions on almost a weekly basis. He puts out a great podcast called the Wealth Steading Podcast, where you can learn to grow your wealth like you grow your garden, which we'll be talking about today. It's a short show. It comes out once every week, sometimes once every other week. Doesn't take a lot of time, but it brings you an awful lot of wisdom. Again, it's at wealthsteading.com. With that, let's dive off into this. And again, this is going to be, I think, a good topic for everybody. But I do run into this all the time. I get a lot of different questions that show me that people have not just the cart in front of the horse. They have the cart down the street, around the corner, and in the next neighborhood, and the horse is taking a dump behind the woods, right? They're just, and I'm not picking on anybody. We all have it happen to us. The worst thing that happens then is you get a larger property and you start working things way outside of your intensive managed area and you lose control of things. Ask me how I know, right? I'll admit my own mistakes. I never hide from them. And so what we end up with is people that feel a couple different things. One, it's important that I grow all my own food. You're not gonna. Farmers don't grow all their own food. And I don't just mean farmers that grow, you know, of course, here comes the jet strafing us again. I must be getting too close to the truth again. But I'm talking like farmers that do mixed vegetables and livestock still bring in some food for themselves and their families because we all like variety and not everybody's going to do everything. The person that grows rabbits for meat is probably not also going to grow pigs for meat. So they might want some pork. So they'll probably buy some pork, barter from some pork, go to the store and get it, whatever. So you're not going to do that. So like the first thing I want always people to do when they start talking about growing all their own food is just, it's going to sound mean, but I'm trying to be direct and honest with you. Shut up. You're not going to do it. You're not. So let's stop having fantasy land and let's get grounded in reality. And let's set a reasonable goal. If you're growing 0% of your own food, getting in one or two seasons to the point where you're producing a quarter of your food, and not necessarily a quarter of your calories, because if you're not producing a lot of your high-calorie things like beef, are you producing 25% of the volume of food that you consume? That's a pretty good way to go. Okay? And if we can just, first of all, let's just bring it back into some level of reality. Then the next thing is, how much space do you really think you need to do that? And some of the techniques that I'll give you today, and if they're properly employed with the right tactics, you can go well beyond that. And you don't have to become the Gervais family in California where they're also selling to restaurants. And, like, the backyard is nothing but raised beds and paths between them, and there's no space left. It doesn't have to be that crazy. It doesn't even have to look anything like that. There's ways you could do it where somebody walked in your backyard wouldn't really, like, it'd be more vibrant. It would be more natural, be more soft-scaping than your typical, you know, Karen HOA neighborhood type yard. But it really wouldn't look that much different. And, you know, that's kind of actually a really good goal when it comes to growing in the suburbs, to not stick out, to not stand out. Even if you're in a non-HOA area, you might not even know there is a prohibition against something. You might do it for 10 years, and no one from Department of Making You Sad ever shows up, and some Karen sees it, gets angry at you, moves in who wasn't there before, calls the Department of Making You Sad. It turns out there is a prohibition on a thing that you would have never heard a word about if it just wasn't known that you were doing it. So blending in is a good strategy as well. But we do not need to try to grow all our own food, and we do not need massive amounts of land. A little bit on, like, well, how much land is enough? My view is that most people can do an incredibly large amount of production on even like a tenth or even a 20th of an acre, like a postage stamp lot. If everything's perfect, if you've got good solar exposure, if your neighbor's not going to complain, what have you, and is if you really go out and do the best you can. But optimally, especially like if you're like a person who's going to buy a place and you're selecting a place and you're going to have to live on a smaller plot of land, but you do have some flexibility and some choice, I would look to go at least a quarter and up to three quarters. And if you can get an acre and a half, great. But like that quarter to three quarter acre range, you can do a tremendous amount. We produced tons of our own food at our property in Arlington, which was actually Mansfield. And it was a third of an acre, 0.33. So almost exactly a third of an acre. And our front yard was a literal poacher stamp. So we were on a cul-de-sac, so the backyard kind of did this yaw out thing. And we had shade and we had sun. And so we did a tremendous amount with that property. And I really didn't even know permaculture and regen ag like I do now. I was just doing old school gardening and some other stuff, some composting and things like that. But that's kind of where I'm at today, is in that quarter to three quarter acre range. You can do all the things that I'm talking about with a couple of caveats. One, when I say that, I mean land. So if you have a quarter acre lot, but you have a 3,000 square foot, one story house on it, you don't have a quarter acre of land to work with, do you? So when I say a quarter acre, I'm talking about a quarter acre of dirt that you can work with. At front and back combined, if you can do things in the front yard. If you can't, then you're looking at like quarter acre in the backyard. Be an optimum. I'm not, you know, if you don't have that, don't be like, oh, Jack said I need it, so now I can't. No, there's plenty of people doing a hell of a lot with 10th acre lots. So that's where I'm at with like going this diverse with this many options for you today. So we got to start out with strategy, right? And we have to develop our context. And so here's what I mean by developing our context. Two people, same piece of land, what should I do? You will get totally different answers if we start from the frame of strategy and context. Because if I ask Bill, do you eat meat? And he says, yes. And I say, do you like rabbit? And he says, no, I only eat red meat. And I ask Tom, do you eat meat? And he says, yes. Well, do you eat rabbit? I love me some rabbit. Tastes just like chicken. I like squirrel. I like guinea pig. I'll eat, I don't care. If it crawls, moves, rolls, if it's edible, I'll eat it. And I ask Debbie, do you eat meat? And she says, no, I'm a vegetarian and I'm a lacto-ovarian vegetarian. So I eat milk, dairy, cheese, and eggs. Right there, all three of those people, we might have some similarities, but we're going to get very different answers. And so we need to figure that out. So we got to start off with our strategy, and our strategy will beget our techniques and tactics. And so strategy is your overriding goal. So if we don't get specific, that overriding goal may not be sufficient to develop context. So I want to grow 50% of my own food. Okay, but the strategy should include what that looks like for this purpose, to develop this plan, to design this system. You know, I want to grow 50% of my own food, but of that, I want to grow 20% of my protein requirements. And in that strategy, you would identify the critters that would provide the protein using rabbits and fish. Or using Muscovy ducks and rabbits, or using quail in fit. You see what I'm saying? Like, you have to figure that out. Like, what does that look like for you? Once you have the strategy down, or maybe you don't even have to get that specific yet, like poultry. I'm comfortable with poultry, but I'm not comfortable with fuzzy bunnies. And some people aren't, and we'll get more into that in just a minute when we do our client interview questions that you want to ask yourself. But if we start with that strategy, then as we start assembling techniques and then getting tactical with where, when, and how they're implemented, we're going to get much closer to the mark on our first edition of our design, is our first rollout, than we would otherwise. And that means our corrections will be much more minor and easier to do. And since we know what we're trying to do, if we make a mistake along the way and we say, I'm going to do this step three, and we put that in and it's not right, we'll identify it much quicker. We can course correct and either eliminate it or rebuild it in another location or another time sequence and then go to step four. And this is much easier to do with a small property than a big one. This is much easier to do when what we're saying is, my strategy is to feed the people that live here. If there's some surplus we sell, we'll get there. But right now, I got one goal, feed the people that live in this property. You know, before I worry about selling it, I'll be throwing apples over the fence to Debbie next door so she doesn't bitch, and giving her some of the eggs so she doesn't bitch. And if you're only doing that, that's much easier to work out than my strategy is to build a 9-acre regenerative farm that can self-sustain itself economically. That's hard. That's hard. Feeding yourself off your land, millions, if not billions, of peasants that still exist all over the world do it right now. There's a lot of people that think they need to be rich to do certain things, and you go, let me take you to the backwoods, and I'll show you millions of broke-ass rednecks and northern hillbillies that are doing it right now that barely financially have a pot to piss in, but they eat well and do well. I had a friend, he was convinced he needed to get rich to have what he wanted. And when he told me what he wanted, I'm like, bro, you are from southwestern Louisiana. And most of the people that you know are broke-ass rednecks and they live that way right now. What's separating you from it? And the answer was he really didn't want to live that rural. He liked having an IT job. He liked living in a larger city. He liked being able to go out. And there's nothing wrong with that. Okay, so then let's get the context framed in. And how do we get as close to what you say you want as possible? All right? So we need to do that analysis. So we need to interview ourselves like we're a client. I'm going to go through this quickly so this doesn't turn into a marathon show today. And there's more questions than this. These are just ideas so you start to figure out what to ask yourself. Do you eat meat would be one of them. Do you eat meat? Do you want to care for animals that you have to kill to utilize them? Because you might say, yes, I eat meat. But the second I said, you want to have to kill a critter, process it, and eat it. If you say no, that changes things. It could be, well, I don't want to, but I'm fine. I'm fine with, you know, the like, if you have a big enough piece of land, let's say, and you have a small flock of chickens, and you have a rooster, or you can borrow one for a little while. So when Karen complains, he's already, I don't know what you're talking about. Ain't no rooster here. He was here for a week. He did his business and he left, right? Or you get eggs from somebody else, or you put your hens with their roosters. Lots of ways to do that. But anyway, you're going to raise, let's say, 20 chickens a year. And there is a facility near you, and you're okay putting them in a basket, throwing them in the back of a truck, taking them there and picking them up. Well, then they're back on the table, metaphorically and in reality, as an option. But you have to decide all this for yourself. Does this resource exist, and am I comfortable doing it? And I would say if you have any doubts, you've never done it before, something you could do is find a local producer who does it already, who sells rabbits or chickens or whatever critter you're thinking about, and say, hey, what do you sell a dressed rabbit for? And let's say they say $20. You say, let me ask you a question. Could I give you $100? I'm going to come to your place. We're going to take a rabbit. You're going to walk me through processing a rabbit end to end for 5 times what you sell it for. And then you do it and you feel okay about it. Well, then you know it'll work. And the worst thing you're is out $100 and he promises it for you. Then take the rabbit home and see if your wife, who said, yeah, I'll eat it, meant it when she said it. And see if the family, the partner, whatever, if what you're doing will actually consume the thing that was produced that way. Because if they won't, there's just no point in it. Same thing with quail. Now, I can teach you how to process a quail in about a minute. And when you get good at it with no tools, young ones anyway that aren't tough, you can process from a live bird to leg quarters and breast in your hands, completely ready to go and cook, even though they should rest after you do it for a little bit to tenderize, in 30 to 45 seconds. And that's why they're great. But someone will probably walk you through that so you can learn how to do it. Are you okay cutting the head off or yanking the head off of a Courtenay's quail? Are you okay with fish living in a pond, in a small garden pan in the backyard, and filleting them? A lot of people that do not want to kill a fuzzy bunny because they're really cute, right, or don't want to chop the head off a chicken or something like that, have no problem killing a fish. So you need to honestly interview yourself about anything that involves taking a life or processing a then-dead animal, including things like, well, how much space do I have? Because if you have a standard, you know, refrigerator, freezer arrangement, killing 20 chickens at once is a problem. 20 chickens take up a lot of space, especially if you leave them whole birds. So what are you going to do with it after you're done? You have to go through all this process, you know, and like rabbits, you can selectively harvest your rabbits so you don't have to do a bunch at once. When you're doing meat chickens that are dedicated meat birds, you might need to move a little faster with how many you. So all of that will play into, well, maybe I am going to do chickens, but I'm only going to do small meat runs. I'm going to have like a little land flock of 4 hens, and I'm going to do a dozen chickens twice a year instead of 2 dozen chickens once a year. All of this comes down to how you answer the questions, right? What fruits and vegetables do you eat? Don't plant peach trees if you don't like peaches. I mean, that's pretty obvious, but people do it. Don't put a lot of effort into gardening if you barely eat any vegetation unless you're going to have a rabbit garden. What's a rabbit garden? I'll tell you about it in a bit. And anyone can golf. I don't even know what his question is because I'm not going to read it right now, but I am going to start it. That is how to ask questions if you're in the live stream. The word question in all caps, and I will come to them at the end. But what do you eat? What do you not eat? You know, and what does that look like? And what ways are there to preserve those things? And how much will you need through your down season and your winter? Like, I still have dehydrated jalapeno peppers from Arkansas, and I've lived here 11 years. I don't need any more dehydrated jalapenos. I'm not dehydrating any. I grow the hell out of them. Whatever I don't use, I give away. And I don't mind growing them because I have a system that just keep dropping plants into it, right? So that's fine, but I don't really go out of my way to be like, I got to grow 100 jalapeno plants. No, I don't eat that many jalapenos. But, I mean, I'm a big user of peppers, tomatoes, and eggplants. So I grow a lot of that. I grow a lot of fennel because I eat a lot of fennel. I don't eat a lot of other things. I don't eat things that are high in sugar. So even the fruit trees that have survived the hell that this place is, most of that ends up fruit drop that's given over to the animals. So if I had this to do all over again and I had the diet that I have now, I would take a totally different approach. And on this property, there's so many things I would do different. In fact, this year when I walk students through this property, it might be all the shit I wouldn't have done because this is a hard property and my lifestyle's changed at the same time. Do you eat eggs? Everybody should have chickens. Do you eat eggs? No. Then you probably, unless you really have a purpose for that chicken to be some sort of composting machine, and you have a neighbor who you know will take all your eggs, you probably don't, or you're going to use them for dog food. Like, but what would you do if you had 4 eggs a day on average for the rest of your life? You don't want to have a bird. You have to feed like a pet. A chicken eats more than a parrot, okay? It ain't as pretty and it won't talk to you. So you better have something for it to do. It better be processing waste and producing a product, or you have an expensive pet. So do you eat eggs? If you eat eggs, quail, chickens, ducks, all on the table as possibilities. Probably not in the suburbs, but if you were small managed area out in a rural area, so would guineas, turkeys, and maybe some other things. Do you eat fish? Why the hell would you grow fish if you don't eat fish? Now, if you love aquaponics and you want to grow koi and sell live koi to yuppies, now you have – I'm not saying you have to answer the question, do you eat fish, with a yes to have fish on your property. I'm saying, okay, then what would you do with them? See, if we can start one of the big things we need to do is eliminate things that we just don't need to be doing on this piece of property. So you have, I'll give you an example. It's really easy, really fast, and easy to understand, and that helps you see other things you would eliminate. You have a 3/4 acre suburban property, no HOA, but it is a full-on suburb. You have a neighbor to the left, right, and behind you. You're not going to do cows. I don't know anything else, but I know you're not going to have a freaking cow, even a Dexter miniature cow, in your 3/4 acre backyard. You're just not going to do it, or something's wrong with you. Something is wrong with you because of that, right? Like, it's not a good idea. Next question, you got to be honest with how much time you have. Everybody says, I have 20 hours. No, you don't. I already know you don't. What do you do for a living? When do you go to work? When do you get off? How much work are you willing to do in the morning before you leave the house? And that will be subject to the time of year. You know how much work I'm willing to do out on my property before I start my podcast? As much as I can in the spring and the fall. Love it. Love it. I have to set an alarm and remind myself, Jack, even though you don't have a boss, you have a couple hundred thousand bosses, you have a podcast to do. Get your ass in the house, put your show together, and put it out. Yeah. You know how much work I want to do in the morning? And I did quite a bit this morning. You know how much I want to do in the mornings right now? None. By 8:30, it's already a bazillion degrees and it's humid this year and I stink if I'm out there. I just do what I have to do, right? And when I had a job, the number was even lower because I had to leave so damn early in the morning that it was dark out before I left the house. So that time was out. You get home. When you get home in the middle of summer, if it's not too hot where you live, you have a long time to work. It might be 9:30, 10 o'clock before it gets dark. So then you have that time available. Now, how much of it are you going to use, honestly? But when you get home, like when I get done working, if I'd like work a full day here in November, December, there's like an hour of daylight left. So you have to figure out where, when, and how you're going to get things done. So you don't build systems that require more time and maintenance from you than you have or you want to give them. And then how complex is that work? Like, who's going to watch your house when you travel? If you travel, do you travel? Do you like to travel? Do you travel once a year? Do you travel often? Do you travel for work? All of these things you have to ask, and 100 more questions we won't get into today. It actually makes a lot of sense to do this exercise. Pull back. I always tell people, when you're trying to figure out what to do in your own life, do not approach it as making decisions for yourself. I know that seems insane. But, I mean, this could be whether or not you get a surgery or not, what you invest in. Like, it doesn't have to just be the subject we're talking about today. Act like you are a third party, a friend you care about, but it's not you. Sit back and how would you interview and then advise that friend and then do it to yourself? So sit down and develop your own questionnaire to interview yourself. And then this is the hardest part. Be honest in your answers to that interview. That will form your context. And then we can start developing our techniques and tactics to achieve our strategy. Because the first thing that interview should do is leave us with a very clear picture of what we actually want. Then we design an overriding macro strategy to get that thing. Once we have done that, now we can begin to select from our techniques and then we can tactically implement them. But before we even do that, we should figure out what are our advantages. What advantage do we have over somebody that has 50 acres? Because you would think you don't have any advantages. Obviously, he has more land. He has all kinds. He does have advantages over you, but you have advantages not over him. You have advantages that you can employ to achieve your strategy. The first thing that this, not really the first thing, but one of the things we really have to do is stop comparing what we do to anybody else. To anybody else. John Willis just sent me an email or a text telling me that Curtis Stone had given me a shout out in a video in the very beginning of it. So I clicked on it and I listened to it to see what Curtis had to say about me. And that was exactly that in the beginning. Like, do not compare yourself to me. Don't compare yourself to Jack Spirko. And he mentioned a bunch of Billy Bond and a bunch of other people. Like, because if you're doing that, you're never going to be happy. Because even if you've passed us, you'll convince yourself you didn't. So don't do that. Judge yourself on your ability to achieve your goal. There is no competition in this. I'm not trying to win most productive farm in North Central Texas. And I guarantee you, as good as I am, I never will because I don't have the land for it. What I'm trying to do is make my life as comfortable and happy as possible within the reasonable boundaries of what I can achieve with my strategy on my property. Take that approach. And some of the advantages you have on a small property, number one, easy to irrigate. A lot of small properties, you move in, turn a switch, and the whole property's irrigated. Yay you. You don't ever have a drought. Now you have to pay for electricity to run pumps, maybe, or solenoids or whatever. You got a well, you need to run a pump. And you got to pay for water if you're on city water. And city water is not as good as, let's say, water from rain catch or whatever, but you got it. And you can always work on other irrigation methods that are a little bit more natural, using rainwater or something long term, but you got that. Even if you have nothing. Irrigating 3/4 of an acre is totally doable. People do it every day. There's companies you can call up. They'll come out, leave, and send some poor guy that has to bore under your sidewalks and shit. And for, you know, a few $1,000s, you'll have a sprinkler system. Okay, you can't successfully irrigate 50 acres economically in a viable way unless you're an actual farm. You probably need more land than that. You're doing, like, circle irrigation or something like that. You're using grants. Like, it's not feasible to irrigate on a broad acre. If you own your own land, a lot of times, like, you would have to put in multiple wells to even irrigate, let's say, 10 acres in some situations. But small holdings, easy to irrigate. And this is why Zone 1 permaculture is almost always irrigated. That's actually one of the ways we defined it, that it's irrigated and it's intensively managed. Okay. It is easy to manage because nothing gets away from you. You know, you can take a few days on a property, even my size, and I don't go over there, and then I go over there and everything's freaking overgrown and now I'm tired and it's hot out and I don't want to do it and the mosquitoes are biting me and those damn things, the beggar's lice hitchhikers are sticking in your arm when you reach it, and it sucks. When you have 1 acre or less surrounded by, you know, wooden privacy fence or shit, whatever, you look out in your backyard, you see everything. So as soon as something starts to move a little bit outside of what you're trying to manage it to do, you identify it and you correct it. And that makes it easy to maintain, right? So they're easy to manage. They're easy to shade, including shading certain spots. Like one of the things I love to grow in my aquatic systems is a plant called azolla. I just uploaded the video, but I haven't turned it on yet because I have to do some editing to like the title and everything. But this morning, when I went out to hang out with the ducks and the gooses and the goose ducks, what are goose ducks? You find out this morning. And you'll find out later when I turn the video on. You want me to tell you? No, I'm not going to tell you. I have to wait for the video to come out. It's no big deal. I fed them azolla. So I did a little video with that. Well, right now, like my big Miyagi, my 12x12, 4,500 gallon Miyagi pond, has no azolla except the handful I threw in a day for the koi to eat. Why? Well, one, because the koi eat it. But the other reason is because it's so intensely hit with sun this time of year that even though the water's kept cool by things that like sun, like water lily pads and stuff like that, that give a top cover, the azolla needs open water to grow in, and the sun just murders it. But just 25 feet away from it, I have a metal tank, about 400 gallons, 470-gallon tank, and it's covered in an inch deep of azolla I feed the ducks. Why? Because it gets dappled shade from a live oak. On a small property, you can put things up like a deck with an overhead pergola and throw a 30% shade cloth on it. Really, really easy. You can do that on a big property, but only on so much of an area. So these smaller managed areas have this advantage, whether it's a big property or small property. That's what I'm trying to get out to you. Even you guys with larger properties should be thinking this way, that intensive managed zone one, zone two. The problem with small properties is it may be very difficult to open up areas that you need more sun into. Like if your neighbor has a giant elm tree, you probably aren't going to be able to convince them to cut it down, because if it was my elm tree, I probably wouldn't cut it down for you either. Okay. Or a big magnolia, or it doesn't matter what the variety, you get what I'm saying. Or if the housing is close enough together, the building itself shades part of your property 80% of the day. Well, that's going to be the case. If the fencing shades an area, if you have an area between a fencing and the side of your house, it's almost 100% shaded. Those areas are not going to be opened up. So then what you want to do is ask yourself, what can I do with that area that makes the most sense? Everybody says grow mushrooms. Where do you live? Do you eat mushrooms? That's not necessarily the answer. It might be a great place for composting. It might be a great place for rabbit hutches. Turns out rabbits don't like it when it's 107 degrees out and they're getting the sun beat down on them. And if you can make some sort of mobile rabbit hutch, then maybe the rabbits live there in the summer and don't live there in the winter. They live somewhere where they get some southern exposure and better sunlight during the day, right? You have to think about all the way through these, but these are all easier decisions to make because the restriction itself leads you to the answer. We have gotten into a point where we're so spoiled as a people that restrictions, we see them as bad. And if it comes from government, it probably is. But restrictions that are physical and natural, those are opportunities for us to see the eloquence of the design. If we can design around those restrictions, we can turn those restrictions into advantages. Yes, it's shaded here, but this is where I grow my plants that would bolt in the summer if they were in the sun. Like cilantro would be an example, or maybe certain greens that would bolt in the sun. So we have to think about that way. Another advantage, and kind of right in with that, is we have many microclimates. When you have a more high density of infrastructure, it's not just Karen's house next door and Bill's house on the other side. It's the fence, right? You create wind blocks in the suburbs, which, so you have still areas, and you also create wind funnels that are higher wind areas. So there's, and we have areas that are almost always shaded, almost never have sun on them. Then you probably have areas that never get any shade, and all types of things in between. And this wall on this side of the house may really heat up in the afternoon, even if it doesn't get direct sun on the ground. The wall itself warms up, and that's a thermal battery. And so we might want to use that area to plant something like an espaliered vine that wants heat to ripen fruit early, or espaliered a tree, like a pear or an apple can actually be espaliered, which is we grow up more in the frame of something like a grapevine. To gain from that heat. Or we might have a wall that remains really cool because it never really gets hit with the sun. And during the summer when we're air conditioning the house, the coolness of the wall is actually radiated out. No matter how well we attempt to insulate, there'll be some level that wall will be cooler. I see it with, I can tell you every cool spot on my back porch where my walls are, where it's cool. It's where the cats lay in the middle of the summer. I don't even need my thermal gun. I just watch the cats, and when that cat plants himself up, I can go over there with my thermal gun, and I'll find a 15-degree heat variance. And that cat knew exactly where it was, right? So we can use that natural observation. So these are all the things we need to think about. Now, we can really begin to think about some of the things that we would want to do with it. One is that gardening, yes, it's for everyone. But what are you going to garden? What are you going to garden? See your answers to your questions. I could see, if you put me back at the property that I had in Mansfield, and if I was going to do rabbits, which I probably wouldn't, because my answer to the question of do you eat rabbits is yes. Does your wife eat rabbits? Nope. Okay. Right there, I'm probably not doing it. But if I had rabbits there, I could see turning some of the garden beds that I had there into rabbit gardens, which we'll get to in a bit. I wouldn't necessarily worry about growing that much vegetation for myself. Right now, 50% of my garden space is growing flowers to attract pollinators because I like them, things like that. I'm growing lots of herbs and other things too. I'm not growing that much vegetation because I don't eat that much vegetation anymore. Again, I really like peppers. This time of year, I like tomatoes, so I grow some tomatoes. I make bruschetta. I make pesto. Again, more on that in a bit when we talk about herbs. But we need to figure out what kind of garden do we grow. We also, if we start looking at meat production in that place over there, not only would I have had my rabbit garden, I can in my head see that property and this one whole side of the property that got sun all the time. I would have put a row of fodder trees in there. I would probably have done a mix of Nick's stuff. Like hybrid poplar, mulberry, and willow, hybrid willow, maybe some lace bark elm. And then I would have had all the fodder I could possibly need to feed rabbits. Plus, I would have had the lawn, which grew tons of forbs and stuff because I don't do monoculture grass either. And I would have had the rabbit garden. And with that, like I can make as much meat as I'm willing to process for myself. In that environment. And that was, again, about a third of an acre yard. So fodder trees. And that's probably, for a lot of people, it's probably a better ROI than growing apples and peaches. Fruit has its own problems. So fruits end up with insect infestations. They end up with fungal infestations. You need, when you're growing fruit, I don't care how well you think you can do it, you probably need some level of tree management program. You need some level of spraying. That does not mean chemicals. But you can look at like Howard Garrett, the Dirt Doctor's website, and his fruit and nut tree program. You need something like that to get good, reliable, continuous production. Where fodder trees, you just grow leaves. You're good. You did it. Now you have fuel, you have fiber, and you have food for your wildlife. You're not going to live on mulberry and willow leaf. But your rabbits and certain other animals can, right? Or we can take something like mulberry leaf and we can feed it to something like black soldier fly. And then we have feed for things like quail or chickens or fish. See where I'm going with that, right? So fodder trees may be a really great play in your system. I'm not going to grow any of my own meat, or all I'm going to grow for meat is chickens for eggs, and I don't want to do black soldier flies. Then fodder trees are probably not a really great play for you. You're probably better off with like a Home Depot food forest, right? A peach, a pear, a nectarine, a couple apples so you cross-pollination, and then do backyard orchardry. Again, this is all about the context of what you're trying to achieve. If you do have bunnies, then I implore you to use YouTube University and learn how to make a mini hay baler. You can make a mini hay baler with basic, you know, you could probably do it with hand tools. It'll just be light, you know, life is better with technology. So cordless power tools and a few other things, and mostly just plywood. And a few pieces of hardware, you can make a great little hay baler, and you make little mini hay bales, and all through your growing season, you make hay for your bunnies, and as you're making hay, you're also taking fresh cut and feeding them that through the summer, and by the time you get to winter, you have a nice little stack of hay bales, and you're not the idiot, and they are idiots, down at Tractor Supply, buying a mini hay bale this big. And I'm holding my hands a little wider on my shoulders for people on the audio, and you're paying $40 for it when you could grow it right in your own backyard. And the rabbit garden, this is where we get to the rabbit garden. There's a lot of ways to do this. One is you can grow a lot of vegetation that is for humans that rabbits will also eat, because you can grow way more lettuce, and lettuce does not store well. It doesn't make hay either. You can grow way more lettuce than a family's going to eat unless you eat a hell of a lot of lettuce. These rabbits will eat it all. It's easy to produce your own seed. You do not give a rip about cross-pollination if you're growing lettuce for rabbits, because they don't care either. There's a lot of different greens. There's things that are even perennial greens that we grow as annuals in our climate, like longevity spinach, some of that. Chicory. Like if you feed rabbits chicory, you can forget about internal parasites. If you have pasture, you're putting sheep on it, and you're growing chicory in your pasture, and I don't mean a pasture of chicory. I mean like 5% of the vegetation, your pasture is chicory, your sheep are not going to have jack shit for parasites. That's well documented. It works for rabbits too. So there's all types of things we could be growing in that garden, some for humans, some for rabbits. But we literally could take a couple 4x8 beds and be growing a mix of grasses and forbs to feed rabbits and to make hay for rabbits, and not even worry about the yard, the lawn. You see, and you can produce so much biomass that fast. Because, and this is the beauty. Your soil in those beds is going to get better and better and better every year, because here's something you're never going to do. You're never going to let those plants reach maturity before you cut them for the rabbits. As they reach maturity, the quality of the vegetation goes down as they produce their grain or their fruit or their seed. So we're always going to basically be haying, whether we're cutting and feeding or cutting and baling, right? We're always going to be cutting first, which means the plants will remain at maximum efficiency of putting carbon and exudates into the soil. See that, and you'll learn this if you take the course that we'll be releasing next month on cover cropping and soil in the backyard. Plants are using their roots and the soil itself to functionally create batteries. And as they reach that point in time where they go over and say, I have to make more plants, I have to make seed, I have to make fruit, then they draw from it. So while they're actively growing, they're constantly photosynthetically improving the soil. And then they take back. So haying done properly, and it almost never is, can actually improve soil. It requires extreme diversity of plant type, and it requires intelligence, and it requires the eventual termination of the crop and successing into a new one. But it's all very, very doable at the backyard scale for feeding things like rabbits. Or again, if we can create biomass that can be fed to worms, worms can be fed to birds. If we create biomass that can be fed to black soldier flies, then we can feed black soldier flies to birds or fish. Worms can go to fish as well. So let's kind of go on further with that and talk about worm farms and black soldier fly composting. I don't want Jack to spend time growing garden beds so that I can feed birds. I don't want to grow this stuff, feed it to black soldier flies, and then feed it to birds. But I like the idea of filling black soldier flies to birds. Okay. Let's back up with that for a minute. Let's say you have a big enough property to have four garden beds. You need two garden beds to produce food for you. If you have rabbits, what an ideal situation to use two each season to produce food for your rabbits, two for yourself, and crop rotate. And use the rabbit manure in the beds as you hay them so that you have maximum fertility, huge amounts of biological life. So there is a way to do that too. But if you just want to make black soldier flies in grubs so that you can feed, you know, something like quail, because quail are great. They're quiet. They're easy to process. You get meat and eggs. You can hatch them yourself. You can brood them yourself. You can be 100% self-sufficient except for feed, because it's very difficult for you to grow enough grain and seed to effectively feed a colony of quail and keep a good amount of production coming through where it's worth doing if you want meat on a regular basis. So that ties you to the feed store. So maybe we don't get away from the feed store. There's no problem with buying some feed, but what if we don't want to feed them 100% from that? Well, then we can do black soldier flies, and we can drastically cut their feed bill. And you don't want to do the fodder trees and feed the soldier flies, or the garden feed the soldier flies, or the aquaculture, soldier flies will eat the hell out of azolla and other aquatic plants. I don't want to do that, okay? Starbucks and a juice bar, and you got all the material you want for the rest of your life. Black soldier flies and worms will both eat the pulp the juice bars throw away, and they will both eat coffee grinds. So, you know, if you have a nearby Orange Julius and you have or whatever the hell, Jamba Juice or whatever the hell it is, and a nearby Starbucks, I guarantee you, you can't process as much as they're willing to give you for free. And unlike when you go to like a grocery store or a school cafeteria and all, you have to finagle your way into getting that supply chain, because they're always afraid because it's a lot of it's actually good food that expired and all. They're always afraid you're going to eat it. They are worried you're going to feed it to animals. You have to convince them that you're, you know, going to compost with. When you go to Starbucks and go, can I get coffee grinds? They just go, here's a giant bag. Get it out of here. And then I'll have to drag it in the back. They're heavy as shit, by the way. They're heavy as shit. In fact, what I recommend is you get a big tub, you know, with wheels on it, like one of those style, because that way you can put the bag in the tub and drag it to your vehicle, and it won't drip and make a mess and rip open and stuff if you do that. Amy says quail love comfrey. So you can do some gardening for your quail. As Amy's pointing out, they do love comfrey, but you shouldn't feed any animal comfrey as a primary diet. Comfrey is incredibly safe, but if it's overconsumed, I believe in the trials that were done with pigs, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of when comfrey made up 30% of their diet, they started dying. When it made up like 15, 20% of their diet, they thrived. Anything can be a poison with the right dose. But you can do some things. Do you know what they love? They love microgreens. But microgreens are too valuable for quail. But what you do is you grow your microgreens, you trim your microgreens, and you take the whole tray and stick it in with your quail. They'll dig through the dirt, they'll eat all the roots, they'll eat all that shit. But you probably still need to feed them some grain, right? But the black soldier fly, with a waste stream tied into from a local coffee shop and a local juice bar, you can make 50 if you have room for them and you're willing to do the work. You can make 50 black soldier fly bins. Probably just off two stores. You can make it to the point where you're selling them. You can certainly make enough to feed your flock. You can set some of them up if you have aquaculture where when the grubs crawl up and out, they fall straight in the water. If you have a chicken run system where you have like a coop and run system, which is not my favorite, but it works beautifully in the burbs, right? If that works for you, then you can set up a chicken run with a black soldier fly bin in it, where the black soldier fly larva drop right into the run. A few of them will get away. That's fine. They'll propagate. But mostly your chickens will be like, oh, we know how this works now. And you're supplementing your feed with doing no work. You can harvest what you want to, and then you can dehydrate them, and they'll store without, like, you can freeze them. To be honest with you, they kind of are nasty in the freezer. they swell up and they rupture and they get kind of gross. I mean, it's nothing wrong with it, but freeze drying them. Freeze drying them is too much work. Dehydrating them works great. It works great. And then once they're dehydrated, you throw them in a bag. Maybe you throw a desiccant in with them. You seal them up and you've got food for as long as they last. And people say, you know, I'm going to do mealworms. I wouldn't. We tried mealworms. It was too much work. Black soldier flies, once you figure out how to dial it in for your area, you don't have to buy them. You don't have to worry about it. You give them the environment, they will show up, and they will produce. And the more you produce, the more will show up. Like, their own pheromones and smells actually attract more of them. And I've talked to a bunch of people that do them, and they tell me the number one substance to get black shoulder flies to show up in your bin is wet some dog kibble and then put it in there. And rotting, stinking, fermenting dog kibble is like the dinner bell to every BSL in the area. So we can do that, or we can do the same thing with worms, or we can do both. And now we open up that if we have a good stream of BSL, even if we are feeding some conventional feed or some organic feed to our quail, we're going to cut our feed requirement down to 10 to 20%. Now we're really in a good shape. Chickens obviously love them too. Chickens are just a little easier to provide for, in my opinion, than quail are. Composting in other forms fits really well into this. You have to have something to do with your waste stream. Composting with chickens, I can't really get into, but you could do like the miniature chicken tractor on steroids type thing with this. If you find the right waste stream, you can literally feed your chickens almost 100% with free stuff that restaurants throw away if you find the right waste stream and the right people to provide it to you. In fact, what will probably happen, though, if you're using chickens that didn't grow up that way, the first couple weeks you might worry that they're not eating enough. They might not be real happy that they're not getting their chicken goody in a bag anymore. But what ends up eventually happening is they realize, like, this is a new normal. This is what we get to eat now. And chickens a lot of times are not actually eating the food that we give them. As it begins to rot and decay, they're eating everything from microbes that you can barely see, or that they can barely see, I should say, to insects, to the food once it's 50, 60% broken down. And they will adapt to that and they'll compost for you. The bioreactor compost that I teach people how to make is fantastic in a backyard. The smaller version using a trash can that we have in the course, that works too. But you need to come up with something to do with your waste streams, especially if you're not doing a worm farm or doing black soldier fly, because the value is too high. If you're trying to be productive, even if you're only growing things like fodder trees and a rabbit garden, your waste stream is way too valuable to throw away. We have to start changing the way that we see things. Like, we see, like, all this food waste is a disgusting, sloppy, nasty thing that needs to go to a landfill somewhere, when we should see it as an incredible asset that provides fertility and feed for what we eat, even if we no longer are interested in eating it. Quail, again, I think that if you want meat and eggs, they are way easier to do it with than chickens. A quail cage that's 2 foot by 2 foot by about a foot high. By the way, let me dispel something right now. There are people that put animals into situations that they don't feel comfortable with, so then they come up with something to justify it. Have you ever heard this? Well, the reason a quail cage is only 10 inches high is because you give them a quail cage that's a foot and a half high or 2 foot high, they'll fly and break their necks. No, they won't. That's a lie. It's bullshit. I've proven it. I don't want to ever hear it from anybody ever again. And when somebody tells you that, don't take advice from them, because they do not know what they're talking about. I've had them in tall cages. I've had them in a 50-foot aviary with a 9-foot fucking roof. It is a lie. They will not break their necks. They're birds. They might fly into it, and then they just fall down, and they go like, oh, well, that was stupid, and they go do it again, right? You want to know how quail kill themselves? If you put them in an aviary and you give them open water that's deep enough for them to drown in, those bastards will plunge in there and kill themselves. That's about I've seen two ways they kill themselves. One was that, and two was when we first put them in the aviary. We had a type of nightshade that grew here that they were killing themselves because they were getting hung up in wires in the aviary and smashing their faces and all, but not from flying. And they were just acting lunatic. And it turned out that that particular nightshade was a certain type of neurotoxin. And I basically had hallucinating quail that were overdosing and murdering themselves. As soon as we realized that what was going on, we eliminated it. Like one day, the problem went away. Those are the only two ways I've seen quail kill themselves. And they only ate that because they ate everything else down in the aviary. And it was the only thing left growing, and they ate it last. And we should have caught it, but you learn as you go. That's something else. If you're going to have livestock and you never had, I guarantee you, you're going to kill some of them. Just accept it. Even if you're like, I'm a vegetarian, but I eat eggs, and you're going to probably kill some chickens by accident. It's just going to happen. Another thing I want to throw in as I say that right there, if you are the person, I'm going to have chickens for eggs only or something like that, you will reach a point where that chicken's out of regular egg production. At that point, you have an expensive pet. If you have a flock of four chickens, you get them all as little cute peeps from Tractor Supply, and you bring them home, guess what? They're all going to reach retirement. We call it henopause instead of menopause. They're all going to hit henopause at about 3.5 years at the same time. They'll still occasionally drop you an egg or three, but you will not have regular production anymore. If you go get four new chickens before that happens, yes, when they hit henopause, like at 2 years, you go ahead and get your next four. They take 22 to 26 weeks to start producing. You will not have an egg drought other than the molt. Absolutely. You now have eight chickens you have to feed instead of four chickens you have to feed, and four of them don't produce anything. Nobody wants them. There's no retirement home for them. There's no chicken sanctuary. It's chicken. If you do get somebody to take them and you give them away, they're going to put them into a crock pot, or they're going to feed them to their livestock guardian dog or something. People don't generally keep chickens as pets. If you want to, that's fine, but understand that's what you're doing. What I'm saying is these animals have a life cycle where they are productive in one way, and they will reach a point where they're not. You're responsible for them. Please make that part of your client survey of yourself. But chickens are the easy button. Now, they're more likely to cause a problem in the suburbs with Karens than quail. Quail, I don't have livestock. These are my pet birds. They don't need to know any better. And quail don't really make much noise. The roos make a rrr like that, but it's a noise that most people wouldn't really see as a livestock noise. They just would assume it's some bird in a tree or something like that. And they're not that loud. And generally, you're looking at about 4 to 5 females to one roo with your quail. If you have a chicken with a rooster, you're going to have to Oh, by the way, that I was supposed to say this at the beginning, and then the Vivor thing happened with the sale ending and the inventory going down. I have a rooster. So some of y'all know that follow my channel. I decided to go with Jersey Giant Chickens. I wanted big, lazy, fat chickens that can't get through the fence on the porch or fly over it and will stay out of my gardens. Bantams were exactly what I didn't need, and I had them because I thought they were cool, but they were a problem, and I ended up with like 100 of them, and they were roosting on the roof, and they were crapping on the grill and everything, so they all went away. I got the Jersey Giants, and they only had pullets at Atwood's where I found them. And I'm like, I want a rooster. And I had eight, and Hawk got one when they were still little. I don't think that's going to happen anymore. They look like freaking vultures now. They're so big and dark black. They really do. They look like the black buzzards that eat stuff on the side of the road, except they don't have the red on their head the way they do. And about half grown, when they're half grown, I'm looking at the one going, I think he's a rooster. He is a rooster. And he's just started to crow, and he's doing the whole, like he just can't quite pull it off yet. But we need to name him, and I'm open to rooster names. I'm not going to name my hens, but I always name my roosters. The last two roosters we had were Billy Roy Bob and Reggie, and I do not want to reuse those names. Any other names on the table except Upgrade, my old I don't want to reuse that name either. because there was one Upgrade the Rooster ever. I'm not going to reuse that name, Upgrade from Idiocracy, but I'm open to rooster names. If you want to submit a name for the rooster, TSPC in the subject line, email me, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. Give me a name for a big black rooster. And if I find a few names and I'm in between them, we'll run a poll. We'll let the audience name the rooster. Anyway, chickens are the easy button. They are, in my opinion, the absolute easiest livestock to keep. And it's because everything that we need to know is known. People do it all the time. They did it in the past. They did it just in the recent past. They do it now. They'll do it tomorrow. There's the equipment you need is everywhere. And the damn things have been bred for captivity for so long that they're highly adapted to it. They can be kept free range. They can be tractored, coop and run. They just thrive. I would tell you the only thing you need to know about chickens is it's very hard to change the way that they were raised and have them be happy. So if you have birds that have always been free range and they're adults and you sit them in a tractor, they usually just kind of sit there like this. I don't know what to do. This is bullshit. I'm waiting to get out. If they're brooded in a tractor, they don't know any damn different. They're fine. They're happy. If you put them in a run and they've been free range, then they're like, hey, what the hell? If they grow up with a run, they don't care. They don't care. They don't care. They don't care. People are naming the rooster. I'm never going to be able to find all those names in the chat. You're going to have to email it if you want to be considered. I'm just saying. But they are the easy button. But they do have some issues in the burbs. And one is, if you want to be self-sufficient for reproduction, you have a problem. You have a problem. And that is, causes Karen calls, right? Roosters cause Karens to make phone calls. So unless you live somewhere where Karen can call, and the person who answers the phone goes, Karen, we do not give a shit. Because I promise you, if you call, like somebody calls 911 over a rooster right now, they're going to be told to screw off. So then they're going to make the non-emergency number call to the Tarrant County Sheriff's Department, and they're going to get told to screw off. So I don't care if somebody bitches, and it wouldn't happen here anyway. So unless you know that, that can be a problem. And there's different theories about ways to keep roosters from crowing, and I'm just not comfortable with any of them, so I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to talk about it. So that's one issue. The other issue is they are larger birds and they do need some space. So that can play into it. But they are the easy button. They are not the easiest thing in the world to process compared to like a quail. But they do produce bigger eggs and more reliably as far as ongoing basis without having to do things like lighting or whatever like that. So they're both great options. Rabbits are probably the most sustainable and regenerative meat animal for small holdings. Not just suburbs, but period, for small holdings. You can feed rabbits with a bagging lawnmower. I recommend some more variety, but if you have a good multi-four, multi-grass lawn and a bagging lawnmower, your rabbits should never starve to death. They breed like, well, rabbits. One buck and three doe rabbits can produce more meat in a season than a boar goat. And that's well proven. It's basically equivalent to two meat goats from three does and one buck. Everything you need to know about how to manage rabbits is known. Just like chickens, this has been done a very, very long time. They're generally pretty happy if we put together good hutches for them. We do need to think about things like keeping them warm to a degree in the winter and certainly keeping them cool in the summer. This is not a show on rabbits today, so I'll just kind of leave it at that. But they, again, a bagging lawnmower, a rabbit garden, and some fodder trees, and you can have some of the healthiest rabbits you've ever seen. Make sure there's a little bit of chicory in their feed, and now the parasite issues just are gone. The fertility from rabbit manure is amazing. The fertility from rabbit manure can feed worms in a worm bin, and the worms can feed quail. And the quail make eggs and meat. You can see where this all starts to tie together. And then so we're taking fodder tree, we're feeding to rabbit, and we're producing compost, fertility, meat, eggs. It just goes on and on, the function stacking that happens when we bring them in. I also think that people that live in suburbs should really think about the fact that you do not have to be limited to your own land. Look around and try to determine what other resources are available for harvest. Is there places you can fish? If you have a place where you can fish and reliably catch fish that are good for the table, bullhead catfish, bass, bluegill, crappie, whatever, and you know that at least for a certain period of time, you can go there anytime you want. It's not that far. It's a 10-minute drive. It's a 10-minute walk, whatever. And you can put fish in your freezer. I would not even think about, unless you wanted it for other reasons, putting a garden pond in your backyard. I wouldn't do it. Why? Because now you have a pump you have to maintain. You have return lines you have to deal with. You have something else if you travel for people to watch. Like, there is a sacrifice made for all this aquaculture I have here. There's an energy input cost. So if you can go to the park and any day come home with a cooler load of fish, I would do that instead. Again, unless you wanted to do other things with your aquaculture. Are there other things that you can look at from a standpoint of seasonal harvest? Where I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida, until we moved to Pennsylvania, there was an area not far from us that had just tremendous amount of like public easement full of pecans. And we went out there and picked like a couple bucket loads of pecans all the time. I'm not planting a pecan tree if I have that available to me, other than if I just want the tree for other reasons, right? Especially when I have limited space. A pecan tree is a big tree, and the husks are allopathic. So it's going to impact how other things grow. Now, if I have 10 acres, I don't care. I have a pecan grove over there. But if I have an acre, and that pecan's eventually going to cover, you know, freaking 10th of an acre with allopathic droppings, I'm probably not going to do that, especially if it's there. Apples, blueberries, blackberries. I mean, I grew up foraging all this stuff. That's another thing to look at. Aaron says, there's a park near my dad's that has pawpaws. Well, you are lucky. And I'm not growing pawpaws if they're growing wild right there. And so if you have this ability to harvest, don't lose sight of that. And that can actually compound. And like, you know, if you can buy land somewhere and it's not a huge amount of land, but it like backs up to like publicly accessible land, like a state park or something like that, or state game lands, especially that are underutilized by the local population, then it's like having all that land available to you without having to take care of it, pay for it, pay tax on it, maintain it, et cetera. So just think about that. Realize that things like herbs are also hidden heroes. Like, one of the things that's exploded in my garden this year is basil. I have like 8 basil plants out in my garden area, and they're all freaking 2.5 foot tall now. Leaves on them almost as big as my hand. We make the hell out of pesto this time of year. And since my wife doesn't eat rabbit, what I'm about to give you would work well with rabbit. What I do is I use chicken thigh, and I won't get deep into the process, but the skin comes off, the skin gets crisped up, and I harvest fat from it. All the bones, I debone it, I make stock, I trim all the excess fat, and I render that out. So I have chicken fat for cooking that comes from the fat itself and the skin. I have crispy skins that are like chicharrón, and then we have stock that we make. And then the bones, after we make stock, go in with the dog's food, and then those are made a second time through a pressure cooker into even more bone stock, and they get to where the dogs can eat them without worrying about them being brittle and sharp. So, like, we really wear that out. Where I'm going with this with the pesto is, since we don't eat pasta, what does everybody do with pesto? You make pesto, you mix it on pasta, and it's delicious. It makes a very boring noodle very delicious because it's got basil and cheese and olive oil, right? And, like, pine nuts or walnuts or any kind of, like, sharp nut makes a really good pesto. Black walnut, if you have the patience and you live in the Northeast, amazing pesto made with black walnut instead of pine nuts. But if you have rabbit, you do the same thing. You debone the rabbit or you leave it in quarters and you brown it and you cook it the way that you like it. And then you make pesto and you coat the brown sauteed rabbit or chicken with pesto. So we've taken an herb. We've actually kind of created a meal with it. And what does everybody say about rabbits? This is also stupid. You shouldn't say it. Well, listen to people that tell you this. And that is, if you eat rabbits, you're going to die of starvation. No, you're not. My head hurts listening to you talk. This whole rabbit starvation shit is a myth with a basis in fact. And that is that people that lived in the mountains that were near starving to death already, eating rabbits that were near starving to death, didn't get enough fat and they died. And we all should know by now, thanks to the work of Ken Berry and me saying it over and over again, if you do not get any fat in your diet, you will die. If you don't get any protein in your diet, you will die. And if you get no carbohydrates in your diet, but you get fat and protein, you will live a long, healthy life. There is no essential carbohydrates. The human body requires zero carbohydrates. I'm not saying you shouldn't drink any or eat. I'm not saying you shouldn't eat any, but you don't need it. But you need fat and you need protein. Well, if we're making pesto and we're putting it on the rabbit, we have Parmesan cheese in the pesto and we have olive oil in the pesto and we have plenty of fat. And if you're like, I want to be carnivore. You know what? I have made pesto. Don't tell my wife. I have made pesto with beef tallow. It was delicious. It was delicious. I don't know if it would work with schmaltz, which is chicken fat. I'm not sure. And I don't think it would work that great with lard. But I've done it with tallow, and it was pretty damn good. How do you make pesto? Pesto's easy. I use a little mini food processor, and it's just a few ingredients. It's basil. It's Parmesan cheese. Again, it's some form of fat. Olive oil works best. And salt. And some form of a nut. Pine nut is very traditional. They're also very expensive. They're very expensive. But walnuts make fantastic pesto. I've also made it for my wife with walnuts, which she hates. She doesn't know because the basil is so strong. But like herbs can be a big part of a lot of what you're doing too. Herbs are expensive as shit. Go look what a little bottle of oregano costs and then realize oregano is a perennial up to zone 6. You never have to buy it again. Like basil, thyme, all like your herbs are something everybody should be growing, because even people that are highly carnivorous tend to eat herbs. We tend to use them as seasonings and things. There's purists. They won't even eat pepper. It's like, I eat meat and salt and that's it. And if that's you, fine. I'm not going to argue with you. You're totally within your rights to do that, and you'll be happy and healthy. And I'm fine with it. But I like herbs. And don't be afraid to make some money either. Like I said, we don't want to come at with this as I'm trying to set up a way to make a living off of this. Feed yourself first, but you will find you'll get very good at certain pieces of it. And if you can make some money or do some barter, you know, don't be afraid to do that as well. That's about all I got for you guys today. I do want to take some questions, and I got about 6 here. So if you don't see yours come up, go ahead and re-ask it. I'll take one more around the horn as we wrap up. Anyone Can Golf says, looking at future home properties, what are some of your hard no's, and would you make a pass on property outside of HOAs? We know those are bad. So I think what he's saying is, I know you're going to say HOA, so other than an HOA. Highly repressive laws from a local ordinance that replace an HOA. So right over here, there's a little town called Lakeside. It is 2 miles from me until you get to the city limits of Lakeside. They don't need an HOA. Their freaking police department is their HOA. They have laws like you can't park your own car in your own lawn. So this, and the way I know this is, one dude that was on next door had this really beautiful, completely frame off restored 82 Corvette. And he lived on the corner of like the main drag in his road. So he had a corner lot. So he parked his Corvette on like a 45 degree angle. So it was really visible to the heavy amount of traffic going back and forth, with a for sale sign on it, put an ad up on next door, said it's for sale. Neighbor complained. He said, look, man, I'm just selling the car. As soon as I sell the car, it'll be gone. Neighbor called the police. Police came and gave him a ticket for parking in his own grass. So if the local restrictions from the government are really adversarial toward what you want to achieve, I'm not going to do that. I always try to scope out what the neighbors look like. And if there's something really wrong with the neighbor, I don't want to be there. What I, and then like some of this is situational. like when my son was looking to buy a house, it was the housing market. Like we could still get good interest rates, but the housing market was crazy here. Houses were going as soon as they, you know, like they were going on the market being bought sight unseen. And like one instance, he was going to go see an open house, him and his wife, and it was going to be on Thursday. You could only come Thursday. And you had to come Thursday. And they were thinking, something's not right here. There's some reason they don't want you near this place on a weekend. And it turned out it was a hugely Hispanic neighborhood. And I have no problem with people who are Hispanic. Let me tell you something about Hispanic neighborhoods in Dallas-Fort Worth in the summertime. The whole thing is a party all weekend long. Like, there's places you drive down a road and there is no place to park. And everybody's got blaring Tejano music everywhere. And so this was like next Thursday and had a weekend in between. And it literally said not to come to look at the house. I'm like, no one can tell you. So he drives through the neighborhood. It was exactly what I said it would be. So you have to look for those things that are not universal. And again, this is not against anybody's heritage or anything. This is just, this is a thing that I've seen happen here. And so you need to be aware of it. And so things like that. But anything like that or something that like makes it, like what is the scale of permanence of the problem? If you want to grow food and the property is 100% shaded and there's no way to change that, don't buy that property, right? So you have to individually look at that. But those are just some examples. What would you raise now with your diet? Well, what I do raise. If my wife would eat quail or rabbits, I would have one of the two. I probably wouldn't have both. I'd raise chickens, ducks, and geese, which is what I raise. I would grow primarily peppers, tomatoes, eggplants, certain greens, certain herbs, along with a little bit of cucumber and certain squash, because that's what I do. If I wanted this property to produce maximum calories for me, a lot of the trees where they have survived, I would transition to fodder trees. And I would feed some sort of, like, again, rabbits. I could do on this property, especially if I were to rewind 10 years and said I wanted to do goats, for instance. I could do goats in a fenced-in yard with a great deal of mulch. We have plenty of availability of that so that it didn't become nasty. Move them around a little bit, and I could bring the food to the goat instead of the goat to the food. Or I could do that with lambs. And that would be the approach I would take. I would never try to do even pigs here. I certainly wouldn't try to do cattle. Like, there is a time of year I could graze cattle on this property for a few weeks. But that's it. And it would be, like, maybe four, and they would be here for maybe 2 weeks. And then I would need infrastructure to keep them from going where I don't want. So, like, it just doesn't work. But that's what I would do, and it's mostly what I'm doing. I love quail. I may at some point in my life take a stab at quail again, even though Dorothy won't eat them. Because if I went back to a stack system instead of trying to do an aviary and all, they're really, really, really simple. Rabbits are a little bit more work, in my opinion, than quail. So I'm definitely not going to go there unless somebody else in the house will eat rabbit meat. And that's not happening, so I've given up. Fisher Ken, what should I do with fish carcasses that would be productive? I go fishing often, but worry they will attract unwanted pests and raccoons. Okay, so if you're going to do black soldier fly and you take the fish, you know, you fillet the fish, you got the head, the guts, and everything, you put it in a black soldier fly bin when it's active. When you look back in there in 1 to 2 days maximum, all you will see is shiny bones, which you can just break up and leave in there and make it calcium for your garden. That's one way to get rid of fish. Chickens. If you have chickens, we'll pick fish clean. I've seen them do it. It depends on how many and how much, right? Those are your two best options. The other option is if you have large static compost, you can bury it. And what I do when I clean a fish here, most of the time I pick a spot in my garden. I dig a hole at least a foot deep, which I can do in the garden beds. I put the whole fish in the garden. I bury it back over. I've had one time in one of my beds, some critter dug it up. But most of the time, that puts an end to it. They disappear. They become part of the ecosystem. They add nitrogen and mineral content to the soil, and everything's good. So those are some different options you have for that. Hosk says, what is the butchering age of a rabbit? I'm not super familiar with rabbits, but I believe you're looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 to 12 weeks for bunnies to be ready to go. Ready to go. Somebody that I have no experience raising rabbits. I just eat them. And I'll be honest that the majority of rabbits that I've eaten in my life are cottontails, and they've involved either a shotgun or a .22 and sometimes a dog. Right. So I haven't really raised rabbits, but I think it's somewhere in that range. I do know certain things, like you got to bring the doe to the buck, or if you bring the buck to the doe, she might castrate his ass. Right. Certain things like that. So I don't have a huge, if you are a rabbit person and you have experience raising rabbits and you'd like to come on air and do an interview with me and talk to people about raising rabbits, let me know, especially if you have experience doing this, because there's one person I know that does this really, really well. And I've tried to get her on the air, and she's convinced that she's not good enough to tell other people how to do it yet. And that is colony raising rabbits. I have zero experience with that. I think for what we're talking about today, it may be less of a thing that you would want to do. You know, if you have a couple acres or even a full acre, and you have room and you have less neighbor issues seeing something like a rabbit tractor move around with colonies, because they need to be fairly large. My understanding actually is that in an ideal situation, they can literally have burrows and shit like that. Like a giant rabbit aviary would work, but I don't have any experience with that. So I don't have any colony experience. What I can tell you is that the rabbits that we raise domestically, all right, have been domesticated for the purpose of being raised in hutches. We have systems that work for them. They don't seem to be traumatized at all by being raised that way. What I see a lot of people doing that seems to work really well is they raise their breeders in hutches. They have smaller tractors because now we don't need a full colony because we have bunnies. We don't have adults. We won't get into fighting and shit like that before they graduate. And they're tractoring their bunnies. So they're raising the bunnies with mom until they're weaned, and then they're finishing them for about 2 or 3 weeks on grass. And that's probably a great way to go. But that's as much as I know. It's one of my areas I don't have a lot of information. Christine McFarland says, just processed our chickens this week. Where do I find your chicken skin recipe? Okay, there is no recipe. There's different ways to do it, and it depends on how much I have. If I have no more, then we'll fit on 2 baking trays at one time. I just bake it. And what I do is I lay the skin, the breast skin and the thigh skin are the two that work best for this because they're big pieces. So I take a sheet pan, line it with foil, and I put a cooling rack in it just like you do bacon. I put the chicken skin on it and salt. Sometimes I do salt and pepper. Sometimes I do salt, pepper, garlic. Sometimes salt, pepper, garlic, thyme. Last ones I did salt, pepper, garlic powder, paprika. That was really good. And I bake them until they're crisp. And then we eat them. And you take the cooling rack out of the pan once it cools down a little bit. And you pour it into the jar just like you do bacon grease. That's one way. There's too much skin to fit on 2 trays, I take a frying pan. And I fry the skin about halfway there. That'll shrink it up a lot. And then what would have normally taken 4 pans will fit on 2. And I finish them in the oven that way. And when I do that, I put the salt and whatever seasoning on them when they go on the tray, not when they're in the pan, because it all comes off if you do that. The other thing I do when I do that pan method, after the skin is moved to the oven, right? Or if you don't have a lot of skin, you can always just fry it. Just throw it in the frying pan. As soon as it comes out, hit it with those seasonings, whatever seasonings you want. All, like, when you do a bunch of chicken thigh, you end up with a ton, like a big double handful of little bits of chicken fat. When you pull that skin off, especially thighs, you'll see a couple lines of chicken fat. And it will actually make too much oil when you're trying to fry and get a brown on your chicken. So I take my knife. I use that boning knife from Victor Knox that I recommend. And you just kind of push, and the fat will come right off with a good sharp knife. All that goes in the pan and renders down as much as I can.
I take those out in little nubs, whatever doesn't render, and the dogs get some, and I throw salt on it, and I eat it, and then the fat goes in the jar. And usually, like, if you buy chicken, two big packs of thighs will make about a pint jar. Pint jar? Yeah, pint jar of chicken schmaltz. That's a lot of chicken fat, and I'm going to tell you a secret about chicken fat. It is one of the freaking best fats to cook steak in. You get an amazing sear. If you don't use too much of it is the key. You just need a little bit. In fact, a great way to do it is to actually melt a little bit of it and brush the steak with it and then go into a dry pan. And then you, or go onto a hot griddle, like you get this gorgeous sear with chicken fat. And beef tallow works really good to get a good sear on chicken. It's weird, I know, but it does. Little cooking hack there at the end. And then just a thank you to Paul for a $20 super chat. Thank you, sir. No question with that. But if you super chat me, you will always end up starred because the system does it automatically. I do not see any more questions. Last question I see is the one I just answered. Okay, wait, got another one. Fred says, can 10 Cornish cross be kept in a 10 by 10 foot run that doesn't have grass and be healthy? I can give them grass after a cut. I can't free range them. Yes, what you need to keep chickens in a run is deep litter. And you need to be adding deep litter. So in addition to like giving them whatever vegetation you want to bring to them, whatever feed you want to bring to them, you want to keep an eye on it. And if it starts to be any kind of nasty, add more carbon, add more carbon, add more carbon, add more carbon. Absolutely, you can do that. Let me see if there's any other questions. I don't see any more questions. Okay, we do have an answer, though. Little Farm That Could says 16 to 20 weeks for rabbits that I do. Okay, there's your answer on the rabbit. Like I said, I don't do that. Again, if somebody wants to, 1 Million Pumpkins says rabbits can be violent. And he's not only joking about the Monty Python thing. Rabbits can be violent, and one thing I do know is when you're pulling rabbits out for processing, smart people wear something that protects their arms because they can claw the shit out of you down to the point where if they get you just right, they can cut like into one of the veins in your wrists. Rabbits can be violent. I've actually heard from a lot of people that are like, when I started keeping rabbits, I didn't know if I'd be able to kill them because they're all cute and fuzzy. And when they're actually raising meat rabbits that aren't like pets that are handled all the time, like, rabbits are dicks, man. I don't have any problem killing them at all. So there is that. Anyway, we don't have an item of the day for you here at the end because we already did that at the beginning with the Vivor thing. But if you missed that, I'll just tell you real quick. The ice maker that I had yesterday, a ton of you bought it. I saw a comment this morning on the blog said, these things are over $300. I'm like, no, they're not. I clicked on it. Yes, they are. So the price went way up. But as of when I started anyway, you could still get them on Amazon. So on my write-up, and there's a link in the show notes where you can see the write-up for that ice maker, you can get it right now for like $170 on Amazon because the inventory there is held different than the in-house Vivor inventory. It's the same one. I put a link so you can make sure that you're getting the right one and so that I can get credit for the sale, obviously. But you can always find everything that I recommend at tspaz.com. Tomorrow it will be Thursday, and Thursday we are going to have a expert counsel Q&A, and we'll have a Friday flashback. There's been a bunch of text messages coming in. I'm working something out with Matt Powers. Matt and I are probably going to do a simulcast live stream next week. We're going to talk about a lot of stuff that we were hitting on today, like composting, bioreactor composting, both of our input. Like I said to him, I think it'd be kind of cool to get like Science Geek and Redneck Duck Farmer together to talk about basically the same thing using different words because it helps more people understand. I think we have a Bitcoin interview next week as well. So good week coming up. We're also going to run into the holiday. I think next week's going to be the show on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and I don't even know if there's going to be flashbacks or anything next week. I think I'm just going to take the holiday off with my family and enjoy that. With that, I enjoyed being with you guys today. Remember, what we talked about today does not only apply to small properties, it certainly does, but even larger properties that intensively manage zone 1 and a little bit zone 2. that's where the majority of what you eat that comes from your property should probably come from, unless you're grazing cattle or something like that. Take care, guys. I will catch you tomorrow with that expert counsel show for the week.
Are they going to bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.